your relationship with music, it seems to me, began because of the city of Oakland. Is that fair to say, to some degree?
I'd say, yes.
Explain.
Well, as a kid in Oakland, I was going through the term of formative years at that particular time, and I was listening to pop music at that stage of my life. And then Oakland also had a lot of clubs and radio programs that were of other types of music, rhythm and blues and jazz. Dixieland jazz, modern jazz, what have you. So there was a vast amount of things to listen to, and I listened to it all.
There was a Clint mentioned to me in the course of the book that it had a very large black population, Oakland, particularly during the war years, because black workers migrated to work in the shipyards and so forth, and that there was one particular station, I think, that played a kind of ear opener music for you, which was rhythm and blues, I guess. And
I think there was a station called KWBR, which was a rhythm. They played rhythm and blues, and then they'd have jazz programs as well. And they'd play, which were termed in those days, they used to call them race records, which were records, very small labels that would play mostly black artists. And so I got to be exposed to a lot of people that you didn't hear on the regular pop market. Frankie Lane, Frank Sinatra Group was in the pop market at that particular time. The Johnny Ray, who else? And anyway, in the rhythm and blues market, there was the Wynonie Harris and the Joe Houstons and the Ivory Joe Hunters and a lot of the people, some of them still playing today, even UJ McShann, who played with us here at Carnegie Hall a few weeks back, was making records at that time on those labels.
All of this evolved for you, Clint, into an interest in jazz. I think that could be traced back to 1946 and a jazz festival and all of those people at the same time on the same bill.
Yes, there was I remember going to the Jazz at the Philharmonic, and I used to go out and hear Lou Waters and the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, which was a trad jazz, traditional jazz, Dixieland jazz, what have you. And then I started going to Jazz at the Philharmonic. They had a tremendous program in those days. They had Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young, Flip Phillips, and Hank Jones and Joe Jones, Howard McGhee, tremendous array of people, and they would. It was quite impressive. Quite impressive players, and it was fun to. You don't see that much anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't see that kind of gathering much anymore. It's kind of an experience that affected me a lot. I just thought, wow, it's interesting, these people. And they're playing, and they're just playing for themselves, but they have these jam sessions which are for themselves, but the audience would get with and enjoy. Just in case, maybe.
One of the things I felt, that I was in researching the book, I read a piece by Ralph Ellison about modern jazz players.
The 1962 piece.
Yeah, and I had not read that piece before. I felt, and Clint kind of confirmed it in his talking to me about Charlie Parker, there was those black musicians in the modern jazz school, kind of came out and just played. They didn't, suck up to the audience. They were deliberately not showy showmen. It was almost a challenge to them. And I felt when I read that piece that there was something in Clint's acting manner that came off of that kind of jazz manner.
If you make a movie and you start predetermining how the audience is supposed to feel or what the audience is supposed to be reacting to, sometimes you can get sidetracked by listening to the results of it rather than just saying what you have to say and saying, look, if you don't like this, you can leave. It is a quote in a movie I was in called White Hunter Black Heart, where the John Wilson character says it. He says, "I don't." He says, "If you're making a movie for you, you can't let 2 million popcorn pushers pull you this way or that way. You have to go ahead and do the movie the way you feel. You have to pretend nobody's ever going to see it." Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a little overboard, and that's the character of that particular piece. But by and large, you must have some of that. You must do it the way you feel it should be done, and hopefully the audience responds to it, and that they felt the same way about the material as you did when you first read the material.
Much of what you've just said applies to the musicians and the music that you admire. I know this because I have the list that you were kind enough to supply. Irene Kral, who died a number of years ago, just a first-rate singer, but terribly honest and understated. And the word understated comes to mind. It's been applied to your work and to your self-presentation here in this room and throughout life. And I find that you admire the musicians, the instrumentalists, and the singers who generally understate. And Irene Kral, you did the most wonderful thing for her and her legacy, which is by casting her and her music on the soundtrack of The Bridges of Madison County. And when I heard and saw the CD for the first time before seeing the film, I was so impressed that you had cut against the sentimental grain offered up by the author of the book by supplying us with Johnny Hartman, Dinah Washington, Irene Kral, and others. Did you do that deliberately? To cut across the sentimental
grain?
Well,
I felt that the two characters, because they're sort of outside the mainstream of society, as he wrote it, as he desired in the book, I think the author desired. However, the author in the book went for, it was somewhat smaltzy, I felt the idea of the story was good, and if you could just take away some of that, and I felt that musically, if these two people who are sort of outside both had one thing in common, maybe they liked more obscure music than the music of that particular time in that particular place, and so that gave them something in common. Common ground of which they could sort of spring this friendship, budding friendship, into a romance. But people like Irene, these are people that never got the credit they should have in Lifetime. Johnny Hartman, I remember seeing as a band singer with Dizzy Gillespie, and at that time he was overshadowed by many pop singers, Billy Eckstine in particular, I think. But he was certainly a magnificent voice, and he sort of stayed in the jazz mode. He didn't go into the pop mode. Has some wonderful albums, but not many of them. He wasn't never a popular recording artist. Irene Kral was never a popular recording artist. She's the sister of Roy Kral, Jackie and Roy fame, who play here in New York quite often.
Yes, they're still out there.
Mm-hmm. And they have always been wonderful club singers. And but Irene was quite a special singer, and she's she's understated, like you say. But there's a certain purity about the notes and stuff, and she's just trying to. She doesn't try to fancy it up.
Now the opposite of that would be Shirley Bassey. as you were, we were listening to the lack of vibrato in her voice, except at the very end, which bespeaks modesty of self too.
Yeah, there's a lot. That was a style that was a lot of people emulated, and she wasn't the first to do it. But they would hold onto the notes and then very trail them off and use vibrato just at the end as they're trailing out of it, and instead of coming in and it's a less warbly way of singing, but it also gives
it's
you a
more
chance.
Direct. It's yeah. You plant your feet on the ground and tell the truth is what
exactly.
It is.
Exactly, and it gives you a chance to enjoy the note as a listener a little bit more before yes. somebody starts tampering with it.
I'm Jonathan Schwartz. We'll return with Clint Eastwood in just a little while at 1560 WQEW in New York.